The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, although I'm sure all of you know where you are already. Our library and its 54 branches are the backbone of Philadelphia's civic life. And every year, they welcome people of all faiths, no faith, wavering faith, and even Quakers. Hey, I'm a Quaker. It's okay. This lecture series brings some of the library's great books to life. If you aren't already generous supporters, please fill out the Free Library Foundation coupon in your program and leave it along with an enormous check with Andy Cahan, who will be happy to use it to bring you even more great speakers. The foundation will also keep you up to date on upcoming activities like the Library Festival, which will be April 11th to 16th. My name is Signe Wilkinson. I'm the editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Daily News. And while you puzzle over why they have a cartoonist introducing one of the great biblical scholars of our time, we have one important piece of business to take care of. As you all know, God spoke to humans in a burning bush, through the whirlwind, and in the belly of a whale. God did not use a cell phone. So please turn yours off. If she really wants to get in touch with you, she'll leave you a voicemail. Tonight's speaker, Bart D. Ehrman, was one of my favorite professors, though I never went to the University of North Carolina, where he has taught for over 20 years. I came to him with a classical American religious education. That is to say, after years of Sunday school classes, I understood that first there were Jews, then there was Jesus, then, pretty much instantly, everyone was Christian, which, where I grew up, didn't necessarily include Catholics. Just saying. When I had to teach Sunday school, finally, I realized there might be more to the story. It was then that I began listening to Professor Ehrman's lectures on tape about early Christianity, the New Testament, and who wrote the books that ended up being known as the Gospel Truth. The titles of his lectures on tape are straightforward, like The New Testament, which barely hints at the groundbreaking scholarship he has pioneered, beginning with his Master's of Divinity and PhD from Princeton Theological Seminary. His book titles are much more descriptive. Misquoting Jesus, Lost Christianities, The Battle for Scripture and the Faiths We Never Knew, Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. Because these weren't provocative enough, he is here tonight to talk about his newest work, meekly titled Forged, Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. In addition to writing or editing 24 books and dozens of book reviews, Ehrman has served as president of the Society of Biblical Literature and has won many teaching awards. But to me, his most notable recent accolade is from some Christian students at UNC who find his work so compelling, they have started the Ehrman Project at ehrmanproject.com to counter his views. Look it up. Now, if I go on any longer, he will have written another two or three books in the green room. So let me skip his many, many other accomplishments and introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Bart D. Ehrman.
Well, thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's a pleasure being with you tonight. I'm doing a bit of a book tour for this new book. Normally, when I'm not doing this, I am teaching at Chapel Hill. I'm this semester teaching my class on the New Testament. This is always an interesting experience for me because I'm teaching in the South, in the Bible Belt, and it is intriguing to me how my students have such a firm commitment to the Bible while knowing nothing about it. And so this semester I did what I typically do when I start my New Testament class. The first day of the class, I hand out the syllabus and I explain to my students that this class is not like a Sunday school class. This is not church. I'm not a preacher. This is a historical study of the New Testament, looking at the New Testament from a historical point of view, which works whether you are a Christian or a non-Christian. It doesn't matter whether you are Christian or if you're a Jew or Buddhist or Hindu or pagan or atheist. It doesn't matter because we're doing a historical introduction. And so I hand out the syllabus. I talk about what we're going to do in the class. And then to my students' surprise, I give them on the first day of class a pop quiz. Which they think is very odd since I haven't taught them anything. But I give them this quiz because I'd like to know how much they actually know about the New Testament. And I also want them to find out how much they know about the New Testament. And so it's actually a fairly basic quiz. There are 11 questions on this quiz. And I told my students, I had 180 students this semester, I told my students, if anyone in here gets 8 of these 11 right, I'll buy you dinner at the Armadillo Grill. I bought one dinner. It is not a hard quiz, just to give you an idea. So the first question on the quiz, first question is, how many books are in the New Testament? Well, that's right. Yeah, that's actually an easy answer. It's 27. Now, you may not know why it's an easy answer, but the reason it's an easy answer is this. It's because when you think about the New Testament, you think about the Christian God. Think about the Christian God, you think Trinity. And what is 27? It's 3 to the third power. 3 times 3 times 3, 27. It's a miracle. So my next question to the students is, in what language were they written? Now, this is an interesting little exercise because, as it turns out, about half of my students think that the answer is Hebrew. And I've never quite understood this, but I think it's probably because when you watch all these documentaries on Jesus on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel or something, they're always flashing up Hebrew texts in the background. And so I think people associate Jesus, Hebrew, and they think New Testament's written in Hebrew, which is not the right answer. I normally just have maybe 5 or 6 students who think that the answer is English. which is also wrong. So the answer is Greek. Greek was the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. So educated people throughout the Roman Empire spoke Greek, just as today, if you go to Western Europe, you can get by on English. Back then, you could get by on Greek. And so that's the language of the New Testament, all 27 books written in Greek. And so some of their questions like this. I do throw in a couple of curveballs, because I don't want to buy any dinners. So for example, one of my questions is, what was the Apostle Paul's last name? And I'll inevitably have some students say, of Tarsus. But part of the point of the quiz is to teach them something. And one of the things they don't know, they don't realize, they'd have no reason to know, is that people in the ancient world by and large, did not have last names. So unless you were among the upper elite aristocratic group of in the city of Rome, where you had multiple names, otherwise you had one name. That's why in the New Testament you have all these people with the same name, and they have to be identified. And so you have all these Marys in the New Testament. So and they have to be identified with some identifying feature. So you get Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary of Bethany, Mary Magdalene, etc. And so I have to teach my students this because they don't know that people don't have last names, and so they naturally think that Jesus Christ. And you know, so I have to tell them that it's not Jesus Christ born to Joseph and Mary Christ. So this is just factual information about the New Testament that my students don't know. They don't know this factual information. This isn't really what the class is about. I mean, the class is about scholarship. You know, it's not about stuff you can learn in 10 minutes. I mean, it's actual serious scholarship. One of the things my students don't know that is an aspect of scholarship is what my new book is about, which is that there are books in the New Testament that claim to be written by people who did not write them. There are books in the New Testament that claim to be written by people who did not write them. And that's what I want to talk with you about in the next 25 minutes or so, this phenomenon of people writing books claiming to be someone who they were not. So I'm going to start by talking about a couple of books that are not in the New Testament to just kind of warm us up to the theme. And I decided to talk about a couple of books allegedly written by Jesus' closest disciple and right-hand man, Simon Peter. It turns out we have some books from outside the New Testament that claim to be written by Simon Peter. Some of these have been discovered in relatively modern times. In 1886, there was an archaeological team working out of Cairo, Egypt. They were a French archaeological team. They were digging in a region in Egypt about halfway down the Nile, a place called Akhmim. And in Akhmim, they were digging up a cemetery, and they uncovered a tomb of a person that they thought was probably a monk. They thought this because the person was buried with a book, a sacred book. This book is very interesting. It contains 66 pages, and it's a small anthology of texts. There are four different documents in this 66-page book. The first of the documents in the first 10 pages is what is now called the Gospel of Peter. The Gospel of Peter. It's a gospel that didn't make it into the New Testament, but it's a very interesting account. Now, the way the book itself is structured is the first page of the book is blank, and the next page has a picture of a cross on it, and then the next page begins at the top of the page, but it begins in the middle of a sentence. So that the book itself is not fragmentary, but the scribe who was copying this thing, probably in the 6th century or so, was copying a fragment. Okay, he had a fragment. And so it starts in the middle of a sentence, and it says, the very first words are, and none of the Jews wanted to wash their hands, therefore Pilate stood up. Okay, now, that's interesting. Now, you don't have that line in the New Testament anywhere, but you do have the account in the Gospel of Matthew of Jesus on trial before Pontius Pilate. Pilate declares him innocent, and he calls for water, and in Matthew's Gospel, this is only in Matthew, he washes his hands, and he declares, I'm innocent of this man's blood. And the Jewish crowd cries out, his blood be upon us and our children. This verse that was used for so many hateful anti-Semitic purposes over the centuries. Now, the Gospel of Peter doesn't have that verse in it, but the Gospel of Matthew doesn't have this notion that none of the Jews wanted to wash their hands. So what ends up happening in the Gospel of Peter is that the Jewish people are even more guilty for the death of Jesus than they are in the New Testament. This, in fact, is a very anti-Jewish account. It starts in the middle of the sentence at Jesus' trial, and so it's just a fragmentary account. Starting with the trial, it goes from the trial of Jesus, his condemnation, his crucifixion, and then his resurrection. It is like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in many ways, but it's also different from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in many ways. It is most different from these other Gospels at the very end. In the Gospel of Peter, we have a narration of the resurrection of Jesus. The New Testament Gospels never narrate Jesus' resurrection. You think, wait a second, of course they do. No, they don't. In Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what happens is Jesus is crucified, he's dead, he's buried. On the third day, the women go to the tomb and the tomb is empty. They find it empty. In other words, there's no story of Jesus actually being raised from the dead, no story of him coming out of the tomb. But there is a story about that in the Gospel of Peter, and it's an amazing story. The authorities post a guard at the tomb to make sure nobody will steal the body. This is similar to what you also get in Matthew's gospel. They post a guard at the tomb. While the guard is watching at night, they suddenly see the heavens rip open and two angelic beings descend from heaven. And as they descend, the stone in front of the tomb rolls away. These angelic beings come down and they enter into the tomb. And as the guards are watching, three people come out of the tomb. Two of them are so tall that their heads reach up to the sky. The third, whom they're supporting, is taller still. His head reaches up above the sky. They come out of the tomb, and behind them from the tomb, there emerges the cross. And a voice comes from heaven and asks, "Have you preached to those who are asleep?" And the cross replies, "Yes." Here we have a giant Jesus and a walking, talking cross. How this thing got lost for centuries is beyond me. It seems like this would be one you'd want to keep, but they lost. So this is an alternative account, and it's all metaphoric, of course. I mean, why are these angels so tall? Because they're superhumans. I mean, if they're superhumans, they're taller than humans. Why is Jesus taller? Because he's the Son of God. Of course he's really tall. He's really superhuman. And what's with this walking, talking cross? Well, the cross is a metaphor for the message of salvation that has been brought by the death of Jesus on the cross. Have you preached to those who are asleep, meaning to those people who have died already? Have they now heard the message of salvation? Yes, Christ's salvation reaches even to the realms of the dead. It isn't just for people who live after Jesus. It's also effective for people who live before Jesus. And so this is the Gospel of Peter. One other interesting thing about this gospel is that it is written actually in the first person. The way the gospel ends is, so you have this resurrection narrative, and then it says that at the very end, the last verse says, "I, Simon Peter, and my brother Andrew decided to go fishing. And with us went Levi, the son of Alphaeus, whom the Lord..." That stops there. That's it. So you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you can guess what's going to happen. They're going to go fishing, and they're going to see Jesus alive after his death. And so, so it's going to be a resurrection appearance. What is interesting for our purposes here is that the author claims to be Peter. One of the reasons that is interesting is because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John never claimed to be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The Gospels of the New Testament are written anonymously. Only later editors put on the titles, the Gospel according to Matthew or the Gospel according to John. Later editors were telling you who, in their opinion, wrote these Gospels, but the Gospel authors don't tell you who they are. Not so with the Gospel of Peter. The Gospel of Peter is written by somebody claiming to be Peter. This Gospel was almost certainly written in the early 2nd century, usually dated to around the year 120, 130, 60 or 70 years after Peter was dead. In other words, somebody is claiming to be Peter, knowing full well that he wasn't Peter. This is what I'm calling a forgery. A forgery, in the way I'm using it, is when an author makes a false authorial claim, claiming to be someone other than who he is. Now, when I was in graduate school, I learned that this was an accepted practice in the ancient world, that it was okay to do this. There's lots of forgeries, and nobody thought badly of it. I thought this until about 5 years ago, until I actually started reading the ancient sources. This view turns out to be absolutely wrong. Ancient people talk about this practice of forgery, and in virtually every instance they talk about it, they condemn it. It was thought to be lying, it was thought to be deceitful, and it was thought to be inappropriate. So, why did this person claim to be Peter when he wasn't? Well, Probably because he wanted somebody to read his gospel. If his name was Jehoshaphat and he signed it, Gospel of Jehoshaphat, nobody would read the thing. But if he wrote a gospel he wanted people to read, you claim to be Peter, well, people will read it. That's the Gospel of Peter. A second instance. The same 66-page book has another, I mentioned it had four documents in it. Another document is called the Apocalypse of Peter, which in many ways is even more interesting than the Gospel of Peter. The Apocalypse of Peter is our first surviving account of a first-hand tour of heaven and hell. Somebody is given a personal tour of heaven and hell, and it turns out that it's Peter who's given a tour of heaven and hell by none other than Jesus. Now, you're familiar with the idea of somebody, of a first-hand account of tour of heaven and hell from Dante's Divine Comedy. Well, Dante didn't make up the idea, this motif. This is an ancient motif, and the first instance we have of it now in a Christian writing is this Apocalypse of Peter, where Jesus takes Peter on a tour of the realms of the blessed and the damned. As often happens in these tours of the realms of the blessed and the damned, the descriptions of the realms of the blessed, frankly, are not all that interesting. And it's because there's only so many ways you can describe eternal bliss. I mean, the saints in heaven are happy. Oh, yay, blessed are the saints in heaven. Blessed are they up there in the heavenly realm. Yay, blessed are, oh, how blessed are, yay, joyful are they. Happy, joyful, blessed are the saints. Blessed be they in heaven. I mean, they're happy, they're having eternal bliss. I mean, it's fantastic, but there's only so many ways you can describe it. On the other hand, if you want to describe the torments of the damned, and you have any imagination at all, you can come up with a very graphic and even lurid account. And that's what happens here in this Apocalypse of Peter. Peter tours the realms of the damned, and he describes the torments. As it turns out, in this description of the torments, many people are being punished according to whatever their characteristic sin was while they were alive. And so one part of hell, there are people who blasphemed against God. That was their major sin. They blasphemed against God. These people are hanged by their tongues over eternal flames. In another place are women who braided their hair to make themselves attractive to men to seduce them. These women are hanged by their hair over eternal flames. The men they seduced are hanged by a different body part over eternal flames. And in this case, the men cry out, "We didn't know it would come to this," which I'm sure is true. So you have this description of the realms of the blessed and the realms of the damned. And the point is rather obvious. If you want to have eternal bliss and you don't want to be tormented in hell forever, then don't sin. This account also claims to be written by Peter. It also is an account that almost certainly was written in the second century, probably the middle of the second century, 70, 80 years after Peter was dead. Somebody writing this claiming to be Peter, knowing full well he wasn't Peter, in the ancient world they would have called that a lie. We would call it a forgery. These are not the only two forgeries in the name of Peter from the early church. We have letters allegedly written by Peter that were not written by Peter. We have two other apocalypses that claimed to be written by Peter that were not written by Peter. Writing books in the name of Peter was something of a cottage industry in early Christianity. And it wasn't just Peter. We have all sorts of books from outside the New Testament that claim to be written by Paul, by John, by Thomas, by Philip. Name your disciple. Lots of these kinds of books. The question is, the question of particular interest to my students at Chapel Hill, did any of these forgeries make it into the New Testament? If there are Christian forgeries outside the New Testament, could there be Christian forgeries inside the New Testament? Well, it's a very interesting question, and I think the answer is absolutely yes. There certainly could be forgeries in the New Testament. Why not? When they put together the Bible, the church fathers, say in the 3rd, 4th Christian centuries, they had no way of knowing who really wrote these books. How do we know that they got it right? As it turns out, these church fathers had arguments. Is 2 Peter really written by Peter? Some said no, some said yes. Well, the people said yes ended up winning out, and it got in the New Testament. But did they have any way really of knowing? I want to approach this question about whether there are forgeries in the New Testament by first saying something generally about the prominence of forgeries in antiquity, not just in Christianity, but more broadly. And this, I can keep this very short. It turns out there were a lot of forgeries in the ancient world. We know there were a lot of forgeries because ancient people talk about it. Ancient authors talk about forgeries, and as I pointed out earlier, almost every time they talk about it, they condemn it. We know of forgeries in Roman sources, in Greek sources, Jewish sources, Christian sources. They talk about forgery. And they have a set of terminology for forgery that is just at least as inflammatory as the term forgery. There are two words that ancient people, ancient Greek writers, most of the Christian materials are in Greek. In Greek, there are two main terms that people use to describe what I'm calling a forgery. One is the word pseudos, which is the Greek word for lie. The other is the word nothos, which is the Greek word for bastard. So these things were lies and bastards. They're bastards because they don't really belong to the people that they allegedly go with. And so they're illegitimate children. It was a common practice in the ancient world to write forgeries, in part because it was a lot harder to detect forgery in the ancient world, mainly because far fewer people could read in the ancient world. In the Roman Empire, maybe 90%, maybe probably 90% of the people were illiterate. 10% could read. Well, if you can't read, it's kind of hard to detect forgery. So forgery was more common. Well, what were the attitudes toward forgery? Well, as I pointed out, they weren't good. Let me illustrate attitudes by giving a couple of examples. There was a Roman author, a very prolific author, who was named Galen. He was a physician in Rome, a medical doctor, who wrote tons and tons of stuff. He wrote so much stuff that most of it's not even been translated into English. In one of the books that is translated into English, Galen tells an autobiographical tale. Galen says that he was walking through a street in Rome, and he was passing by a bookseller shop. Inside the bookseller shop, there were two men who were arguing. He can see them through the open window. Two men arguing over a book allegedly written by Galen. One of the men is saying he just bought this book by Galen. The other man takes the book, opens it up, reads the first two lines, and said, this isn't by Galen. It's not his writing style. Well, so Galen overheard this, and it warmed the cockles of his heart because it turns out he did not write the book. So he went home that afternoon, and he did write a book. The book that he wrote is sometimes known as How to Recognize Books Written by Galen. Galen didn't like the idea that people had written, somebody had written a book in his name, just like you wouldn't like it if somebody wrote a book in your name. It was not an acceptable practice. Give you a second example, this time from a Christian source. This is a book called The Apostolic Constitutions. Scholars can date the Apostolic Constitutions with pretty good confidence to around the year 380. Around the year 380, so 300 years after the apostles were all dead. This book claims to be written by the 12 apostles after the death of Jesus. Claims to be written by the 12 apostles right after the death of Jesus, even though it was written 350 years later. One of the most interesting, and in this book, by the way, sometimes they actually talk in the first person. So that there are places where it'll say, I, Peter, say to you so-and-so and so-and-so. I, Andrew, say to you so-and-so and so-and-so. I, Thomas, say to you so-and-so and so-and-so. And it goes through like that with all the 12 apostles speaking. It's interesting that at the very end of this book, there comes an exhortation in which the author of the book warns his readers not to read books that claim to be written by apostles but aren't. How widely was forgery condemned in the ancient world? Forgery is condemned in books that are forged, including the Apostolic Constitutions. Well, so, okay, could there be forgeries in the New Testament? Scholars for a long time have said that the answer is yes, even though scholars have been reluctant to call these things forgeries. That's what they really are. But scholars, by the way, call these books pseudepigrapha. And then they don't tell you what the word pseudepigrapha means. Pseudepigrapha, spelled P-S-E-U-D, pseudepigrapha. What a pseudepigraphon is, the literal meaning of pseudepigraphon is a writing that is inscribed with a lie. But they don't tell you that part. They just tell you they're called pseudepigrapha instead of forgeries because it's a more antiseptic term. Scholars agree there are a lot of books in the New Testament that were not written by their actual authors. For example, I've mentioned books written by Peter outside the New Testament. Inside the New Testament, there are two books that claim to be written by Peter, 1st and 2nd Peter. Almost every scholar, except for fundamentalists and very conservative evangelicals, virtually all scholars agree that whoever wrote 2nd Peter, it was not Peter. It was somebody claiming to be Peter. And you can certainly say that whoever wrote 2nd Peter did not write 1st Peter. Because the writing style is radically different in Greek. It's like you're reading Mark Twain, and then you're reading T.S. Eliot. I mean, the writing style is just radically different. The same person didn't write it. I am one of the people who think that Peter didn't write either 1st or 2nd Peter. My reason is that I don't think Peter could write. I said that in the Roman Empire, 10% of the people could read. Far fewer than that could write. Just because you can read doesn't mean you can write. I mean, in our culture, it seems like everybody can read and write at the same time because we're taught that way. But they don't necessarily go hand in hand. I can say this with some assurance. I can read Greek and Latin and Hebrew. I can't write a sentence in one of those things to save my soul because I never learned to write it. I learned how to read it. Well, learning to read doesn't make you able to write. There have been studies of ancient Palestine, literacy in ancient Palestine. The best studies suggest that in ancient Palestine, maybe 3% of the population could read. 3% could read. Far fewer than that could write. Who are these people who could read or write? Well, they're the upper crust elite. The people who are come from very wealthy families that can afford to send their children to school. Who was Peter? Peter, according to the New Testament, was a fisherman from rural Galilee who spoke Aramaic. If he was a fisherman, he didn't ever go to school. He started fishing when he was a young boy, probably. He was in a rural part of the country. Only in urban areas are people literate, by and large, and his language was Aramaic, not Greek. I don't think there's any way that Peter could write. Now, theoretically, it's possible that after the resurrection, Peter decided to go back to school. And so he took some classes at the local high school in Capernaum. And for his foreign language requirement, he took Greek. And turned out he was pretty good at it. And then later on, he took some composition classes and got pretty good at that. And so at the end of his life, he wrote 1 Peter. I mean, it's technically possible. But, you know, I think Peter probably had other things on his mind than going back to school. And by the way, there is zero evidence of adult education in antiquity. So probably Peter. Some people think, well, what happened then is Peter told somebody to write this letter for him and somebody else wrote it for him. But in that case, the other person's the author, not Peter. Moreover, some people think like it was a secretary who did this on Peter's behalf. So I actually studied secretaries in the ancient world, and it never worked that way. That you would tell somebody to write a letter and they would write it for you. So I don't think Peter wrote either 1st or 2nd Peter. There are 13 letters that go under the name of Paul in the New Testament. Scholars speak of the 13 letters, they speak of the 7 undisputed Pauline letters. Because there are 6 letters that scholars are pretty sure Paul did not write. The 3 pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, Paul almost certainly did not write those. Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, scholars debate, but most critical scholars think Paul didn't write them. Except for, again, for fundamentalists and conservative evangelicals who think Paul wrote everything in there because you can't have lies in the New Testament. But if, in fact, it's possible that there are books that Paul didn't write that could be in the New Testament, these 6 probably are not written by Paul. It turns out that if you sort of add up the numbers, it works like this. The first 4 books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are not forgeries because the authors are anonymous. They don't tell you who they are. So they're not lying about who they are. They don't tell you who they are. There are six letters of Paul that probably are not by Paul. Two letters of Peter that probably are not by Peter. James is probably not written by Jesus' brother James. Jude is probably not written by Jesus' brother Jude. So that just there are 10 of the 27 books probably forged, and maybe one or two more that are a little bit more complicated. How does one explain this phenomenon? These authors, after all, are Christians, and they believed in the truth, and they claimed to be propagating the truth. The author of Ephesians puts a huge premium on the truth. He says that Jesus is truth. He says that you're to put on the belt of truth. He says you're to speak the truth to one another. And yet he lied about his identity. He claimed he was Paul when he wasn't Paul. How do you explain that? I'm not sure how to explain it, but I'll tell you what I think. There were people in the ancient world, just like there are people today, who thought that sometimes it was appropriate to lie. You yourself can think of situations where telling a lie might be the right thing to do. And in the ancient world, there were people who talked about this, who talked about when it's appropriate to lie. Plato talked about when it's appropriate to lie. If a doctor has to lie to his patient in order to get her to take her medicine, that's a good thing. If a general whose troops are getting beaten on the battlefield has to lie to them to say that reinforcements are coming so that they'll fight more bravely, that's a good thing. There are some situations where it's the right thing to do to lie. Now, I don't know if that's the case with the authors of the New Testament or the other early Christian literature, but I can imagine that it's the case, that these authors thought that they had a message that they wanted to proclaim, and the message was more important than their identity. They were willing to deceive their readers about who they were in order to get their message across. Or to put it otherwise, these authors may have been willing to convey what they understood to be the truth by telling a lie. Thank you very much. We have a lot of time for questions, and we have two microphones. And the way I would like this to work is, raise your hand if you want a mic, and while the one person's asking a question with the mic, somebody else raise their hand so they can get the next mic so we don't have to waste time in between things, okay? So just go ahead and hand out the mic to whomever you feel like, as the Spirit leads. Yes, and could you give the mic to the next person? Yes.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate what you're doing here, and I think all of us are here because we're seeking some more information. I'd like to bring the ancient to right now. 2 weeks ago, I watched my local school board have a debate about discrimination of LGBT people. I noticed that at the debate, someone took the Bible and quoted verse to discriminate, which I'm sure happens all over the place. Thankfully, the school board sidestepped those arguments. Given your body of work, the question I have is, you get to crisscross the whole country. What is the national conversation going on? You see changes in your effect of your works and your literature, because I was really kind of taken by my own neighborhood. You know, it's like a bumper sticker I saw when I came over here. If nothing changes, nothing changes. It's going to be a call to action, also a call to inaction. You know, and some people don't want anything to change, and it's very threatened by some of this. I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit about what you may be able to see about the effect of your work over the last few years in the conversation as you see openings that have happened as a result of this.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, with respect to my work, the main change I've seen is I seem to be getting a lot more hate mail than I used to get. I don't quite understand that, but it seems to be increasing in volume. And one context that I speak a lot in, this might seem a little bit weird, is I get invited a lot to conservative evangelical seminaries to give talks. Now, I never actually get invited to give a talk. I get invited to give a debate. And so I will often debate a conservative evangelical Christian scholar in front of a conservative evangelical audience. So a few weeks ago, I was debating a fellow New Testament scholar who's a conservative evangelical at the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. So there were 600 people in the audience, and two of them were on my side. And so, you know, I wonder, you know, every time I do one of these debates, I every time I start taking notes myself, asking myself, why are you doing this? Because, I mean, it just seems like a hopeless situation. But I'll tell you, the reason I do it is because I think that in my case, I was a conservative evangelical myself. I mean, I was a complete fundamentalist, actually. Just so we're on the same page, so I define my terms. I don't know if you know the definition of a fundamentalist. A fundamentalist is no fun, too much damn, and not enough mental. So we agree what we're talking about here. So I was a complete fundamentalist. And what ended up happening to me is that somebody put a chink in my armor. And once there's just the big discrepancies in the Bible I could handle, but I found a tiny little discrepancy I couldn't explain away anymore, and it just opened things up. And the reason I do these debates and the reason I talk to those kinds of audiences is because I'm hoping I can put a chink in somebody's armor. And I think you've got an increase of, I think the right, fundamentalist right is increasing right now. It's getting stronger in some ways, but there's also a very strong reaction about it. So I think it's a very interesting time, actually, to be doing this kind of thing. Thank you for your question. Yes, and will somebody else raise their hand for the next mic? Yes.
Dr. Ehrman, thank you very much for including Philadelphia in your book tour. If one of the missing manuscripts could be found, which one would you choose and why?
Yes, if there were one manuscript of a book that we know once existed, what would I want? I would like Q to show up. So I don't know if y'all, it sounds like most of you know what Q is. In case you don't, I'll give you a quick explanation. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so similar to each other that they're called the synoptic gospels. You can see them together, synoptic. You put them side by side in column, and they tell many of the same stories, and sometimes they tell the stories in exactly the same words. Now, I have to convince my students at Chapel Hill sometimes that if you've got three sources that tell the same story in the same words, somebody's copying somebody. So my students don't believe me. So I do this little exercise with them, which is I've got a class like that. I come into class and I start fiddling around in front of the class while the students are all watching me. I put down my bag. I move around some books. I take out some papers. I take off my coat. I do some things, and they're wondering why I'm not starting the lecture. But I want them to watch what I'm doing. And then I stop. I say, okay, I want everybody to take out a pen and a piece of paper, and I want you to write down everything that you've seen me do since I came into the room. And so everybody writes it down. And I say, okay, I want four volunteers. So I take four papers, and I say, I want you to compare what you wrote with what each of these four wrote and see if you have a sentence that's exactly the same. And so I go through all four. I compare the four. There's never a sentence the same. There's never five words in common. There's maybe one or two words. Sometimes they'll have the same word. That's about it. And so then I say, okay, now suppose I picked up two of these papers and there was a paragraph that was exactly alike. What would you think? And students say, well, somebody copied. I said, yeah, somebody copied. I said, now suppose I didn't do this today. What if I waited 30 or 40 or 50 years and I didn't ask you who saw these things? I asked somebody who was a cousin of someone who once knew a person who was in the class, and I asked four of them, and three of them had paragraphs exactly the same. What would you think then? And some kid in the back row always cries out, it's a miracle. Yes, it's a miracle. I mean, it's a miracle. Yeah, but then you've got the problem with the differences. And so the way it works is this. There's copying going on. Mark was probably the first gospel. Matthew and Luke copied Mark for many of their stories. They changed it in places. Sometimes Matthew changed, sometimes Luke changed, sometimes they both changed. But there are materials in Matthew and Luke not found in Mark. For example, the Lord's Prayer and the Beatitudes. They didn't get it from Mark. And there's evidence to suggest they didn't get it from each other. So where did they get it from? So they got it from another source. So the scholars who came up with this idea that there was another source were German, and they called this other source Quelle. German for source, which isn't very inventive, but that's what they called it. So Quelle is spelled with a Q, Q-U-E-L-L-E. And so when a New Testament scholar talks about Q, that's what he's talking about. And so your question is, what manuscript would I like to find? I'd like to find Q. It doesn't exist. So, yes, next.
Dr. Ehrman, as you know, there's probably great stylistic differences between your academic and popular writings. When you're on your misquoting Jesus tour, I think based off of stuff I've heard from and listening especially to you on NPR and whatnot, the impression given was that due to textual variance, you couldn't really know anything that was written in the Bible. But in Forged, you kind of seem to know enough to do stylistic comparisons. And I actually have an MP3 on my iPod where you say to a conservative Lutheran show that we pretty much know what the biblical authors have said. If I use your own methodology towards the Bible against you, wouldn't I conclude there's a fake Bart Ehrman out there that contradicts himself?
No, it's the real Bart Ehrman who contradicts himself. I don't think I've ever said that we can't know what that we have no idea what the biblical authors.
Just saying that's the impression.
Well, it may be the impression, but it's certainly nothing I've ever said because it's not what I think. I mean, we do have differences in the manuscripts that make it difficult to know what the authors wrote. I mean, that's what misquoting Jesus was about. That we have, you know, we have 5,600 some manuscripts of the New Testament. No two of them are exactly alike. That's a fact. Except for the smallest fragments, but and there are hundreds of thousands of differences in these manuscripts. That's a fact. There are more differences in our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. It's a fact. So it does create a problem. But most of these differences are completely immaterial. As I say in misquoting Jesus, that most of the differences, most of these hundreds of thousands don't matter for anything. The majority of them simply show that scribes in antiquity could spell no better than my students can today. And scribes didn't have spell check. I mean, these students who hand in papers with misspelled words, you wonder what the you can't believe it. I mean, the computer tells you it's misspelled. It puts it in red. I mean, how dumb can you get? But scribes didn't have that, and so they misspelled tons of words. So I think these differences, that some of the differences are really significant. But I don't think that it means that we just throw up our hands and say we have no clue what the Gospel of Mark said. We do have a clue what Mark said. We have manuscript evidence for what Mark said. So if that's the impression that has been given, it's not the impression that I mean. I mean to say that there are significant differences, but that doesn't mean that we just throw up our hands in despair. So,
In your opinion, in your opinion, during the second and third centuries, did authors of the New Testament books and the Gnostic Gospels use pseudonyms out of fear of repression by the Romans if they revealed their true identity?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the answer is no. I don't think they were afraid of the Romans. This has sometimes been argued for example, the book of Revelation in the New Testament. Sometimes people say the reason it uses all these bizarre images is because the author was afraid that if the Romans got a hold of it, he'd be in big trouble because he's bashing the Roman Empire. I actually don't think that Christian authors were worried about that. We have Christian authors who talk about about their relationship with the Roman Empire. There's never, ever any discussion that they're afraid some Roman's going to read a book of theirs and they're going to be persecuted for it. So I don't think that is one of the reasons. The main reason I think that authors, Gnostic authors, as you were saying, or other authors wrote pseudonymously is because they wanted people to read their books. And so if you were a Gnostic author and you wanted somebody to read your version of Jesus' teachings, you called yourself Thomas, who is Jesus' brother. And so who would know better than Jesus' brother? And so you did it, I think, so that people would read the book, not out of fear that the Romans would get, you know, put you in jail for it or something.
Yeah.
Yes, the next question.
Yeah. Dr. Ehrman? I'm up here.
Where are you? Can
in the
you,
back.
Yes, thank
hi.
You. Yes,
hi, thanks. Yeah, thank you. Although we should, you know, we can see that these works have been vested with authority by the passage of time, should we assume that there was some skepticism from the contemporaries when these were originally composed?
It's a great question. So we do have discussions by Christians about many of these, some of these books. There were Christians who thought that 1 and 2 Timothy were not really written by Paul. There were Christians who thought that Jude was not written by Jesus' brother Jude. There were people who thought that Peter was not written by 2 Peter. We have records of people saying this. And when they said this, they were, part of why they were saying is they were saying this cannot be part of the New Testament because Peter didn't really write it or Jude didn't really write it. So there was skepticism and there was scholarship in the ancient world that I pointed out that it's really hard. It was harder for ancient people to detect forgery, in part because most people couldn't read. But the people who could read, the highly educated people, like in this case with Galen, could do a linguistic analysis, and sometimes they did. So there was a 3rd century church father named Dionysius, who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, who showed conclusively that whoever wrote the book of Revelation, it was not the same guy who wrote the Gospel of John. Eventually, the book of Revelation... So Revelation claims to be written by somebody named John. It probably was written by somebody named John. But he doesn't tell you which John it is. In other words, he doesn't claim to be John, the son of Zebedee, the disciple of Jesus. He just says his name is John, and there's no reason to doubt him for that. But whoever he was, it's not the same person who wrote the Gospel of John, as Dionysius showed, because the style of writing is completely different. Completely different writing style. So eventually, Revelation was accepted into the New Testament because the church fathers became convinced that it was written by John, the son of Zebedee, who wrote the 4th Gospel. Well, they were wrong about that. But the irony is the Gospel of John doesn't claim to be written by somebody named John, but we call that book John. And the book of Revelation does claim to be written by somebody named John. We don't call that book John. But it's just one of the odd things. Yes.
Dr. Ehrman, being involved in a interfaith discussion and study class for the last 2 years, we're using your text and your films for a basis for the New Testament. And for somebody coming from outside of the New Testament covenant, one of the things which I seem to see in your or feel in your discussion is that people had sociological and political and cultural motives for making stories to appeal to various people within the empire, whether they be the Greeks, they be the Jews, the whole debate between Peter and Paul. How much do you think that the forgeries reflected the fact that somebody had a political or social agenda that they needed to address to bring more people into the covenant?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish we had some way of answering it definitively. I don't think we do. But there are places where you suspect something like that's going on. For example, there are some Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, that are forged, that claim that Jesus didn't really suffer and die on the cross because Jesus wasn't really a flesh and blood human being. He was God, but he wasn't human, and since he wasn't human, he couldn't really suffer. Now, that might sound just like a theological claim, but in fact, it might have a political motivation. In an age in which Christians were being persecuted, sometimes to the death, there were some Christians who said, you don't really need to go through all that suffering. And the people who were suffering insisted quite vehemently that they had to suffer because Jesus suffered. And these others, who actually weren't interested in getting martyred, thank you very much, argued, well, in fact, Jesus didn't suffer, and so there's no reason for me to suffer. And so there was a political thing going on there, probably. So there are things like that that you can, that make a lot of sense, but you can't really nail it down and say definitively that's what's going on. But it looks like in some places it was.
I have a question.
Yes. Where are you?
Hi.
Right yes. Here. Okay. Yes.
I've never read anything that you've written before. I was interested in what you had to say, and I think you have a lot of interesting ideas. And I made some notes here, just two questions and one comment. It seems like your theories, some of your ideas or your theories are based on scientific evidence and document dating. So the first question is, how accurate is the document dating that you've relied on, and how do you know that it's accurate? The second question or comment is about Peter and the writings of Peter, 60 or 70 years old after he died, I think you said, that you found or information or something that was written that's dated to be 60 or 70 years after he died. I mean, how do you know he didn't live to be 90 or
yeah.
something like that?
Yeah, good.
And the other question has to do with, I love that story about the giant Jesus and the two angels and the talking cross. And I don't know how that got left out of the Gospels either. I think I would like to have heard that one. But it seems to me that all stories or writings back then, and I say back then meaning, you know, ancient writings like Beowulf, no one really knew what they were describing. But they did it to make a point or a story or to have people believe something or learn something or think about something that could have been different than what they're used to thinking. And I think maybe that's what the Gospels were written to do. Whether they were written by the apostles or not is a good point. And, you know, the point about forging, you know, a writing is important, you know, for honesty. But the idea is, it's what I'd like to say, it's easier to disbelieve, I think, than it is to believe.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's easier to disbelieve or not. It seems like most people believe, so at least maybe it's just the part of the world I live in. But I think you're absolutely right, your view of the Gospels. I mean, yes, I think they're trying to convey something, and that they are filled with story, and that in some instances those stories are historical, but sometimes those stories are not historical. We today, as opposed to people in antiquity, just suppose you're right that people in antiquity really just wanted the stories. People today, I think, want to know the history, too. They really want to know what did happen with Jesus. And so we have historical interests. If what we have are Gospels that tell stories, we have to figure out some criteria that we can use to apply to those stories to see if there's anything historical in them if we're interested in history. And, you know, some people aren't interested in history, and so that's fine. But, I mean, I'm personally interested in history, so I want to know what really happened. On the dating thing, which is a purely historical question, the Gospels are notoriously difficult to date. There is a pretty broad consensus among scholars, including evangelical Christian scholars, about the dating of the Gospels. Most scholars think that Mark was written around the year 65 or 70 of the Common Era, that Luke and Matthew were about 10 or 15 years later, 80 to 85, John maybe 10 years later, about 90, 95. Well, the way they get to these dates is complicated. It's really too much. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to read, and, you know, I could give you bibliography, but I'll tell you the short story, which is if there is an event, so, I mean, the authors don't tell you when they're writing, so they're just telling stories. So how do you know when the stories come from? If they refer to something that is dateable, then you've got something. For example, the Gospel of Luke indicates that Jerusalem is going to be surrounded by the Gentiles and is going to be destroyed by the Gentiles, and the temple is going to be destroyed. Well, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, and the temple was destroyed in the year 70. So Luke is probably written sometime after the year 70. So, you know, that's the kind of thing. If you've got an author you can date, on other grounds, and he quotes a book, then you know that the book was written before that. Okay, so you have stuff like that going on. And if you get enough of that sort of thing, you can almost sort of triangulate to get a date. And that's pretty much how people do it. Peter could have lived to be 90. The earliest traditions about Peter is that he was martyred under the Emperor Nero in the year 64. The earliest reference to that is admittedly not in the year 64, but it's in the year 90, written by somebody who was living in Rome. And so there was a tradition, at least in Rome by the end of the first century, that Peter had been martyred 30 years earlier in the city. And so you have that kind of thing. And the reason for thinking the Gospel of Peter was written 60 years after that has to do with how it lines up ideologically and theologically with other writings that you can pretty well situate on a kind of a chronological timeline. Okay.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation. I also had a question about the dating that he came first. My question is rather simplistic compared to all the scholarly questions that have been asked. You said that the Gospels, Mark was probably the first, and Matthew and Luke, they were so similar. How did John's differ?
Oh, how does John's gospel differ? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really different. You don't realize this just by casual reading. What I did when I was in graduate school, when I was at Princeton Theological Seminary, I did a master's degree that took me 3 years, and I intentionally did not read the Gospel of John. I read Matthew, Mark, and Luke for 3 years. And then at the end of my third year when I graduated, I sat down and I read the Gospel of John in Greek in one sitting. And I couldn't believe how different it was. It is really different that you wouldn't notice at first. So it tells different stories. It doesn't have the same, it has very few of the same stories. It tells different stories. So it doesn't have most of the stories found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't have most of the stories found in the Gospel of John. And sometimes the differences are enormous. In the Gospel of John, Jesus calls himself divine throughout the Gospel of John. He speaks about his own divinity repeatedly, and he doesn't do that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And you wonder, I mean, that would be a rather significant point to make. You know, if somebody called themselves God, you know, you'd think you'd want to mention that part, but they don't. And so, you know, but in John, he does. So I think I have time for one more question, then I need to stop.
I grew up a very conservative Baptist person, still consider myself to be a fairly conservative Baptist person, but I actually, through reading your books, I really want to thank you for your work and the scholarship that you do, because in Sunday school, a lot of stuff never made sense. it just didn't. I mean, there'd be in the Gospels, for example, there'd be times when, there'd be two people in a room, but a third person knows what both of them are saying exactly. And I thought, well, how is that possible? But anyhow, thank you for freeing the text to be what I think it was meant to be, that it was meant to be a faith formation book, not a documentation of history. It's an argument people are making. And I have two quick questions. In the news today, there was notation that they found a bunch of metal codexes that, you know, date all the way back. They said it was the biggest Christian find in history. And I'm wondering, as you pointed out, there are several books that are in the text that are forgeries. Are there books that were excluded from the text because they, you know, I've heard some people argue that, you know, the Gospel of Thomas was excluded because it made too much of Mary Magdalene and they didn't like that because of sexism issues. But are there things that we can figure out were written by gospel, by legitimate persons that just didn't make it into the text for whatever political reasons there may be? And also just the other last thing, which I don't know if it's a question, which is a comment, that in terms of forgeries, I know that there are things such as the Arian controversy, which was started by forgeries, and that it was a very well-known practice in the papacy even, that they would just, whenever you wanted to get something passed, you would say that the last popular pope said it and wrote it, and, you know, and that's the way it is. And so I'm wondering if you could just comment a little bit on both of those.
Yeah, so there are periods in the church when forgeries became very important. This is kind of tied to the political question for political reasons. People would forge things because they wanted. I mean, the most famous is the donation of Constantine, where Constantine allegedly sort of gave the empire over to the church. It was a complete forgery that was exposed in modern times. Are there books that are authentic that didn't make it in? That's a really great question. And the answer, unfortunately, is, so far as we know, no. There are instances where scholars have claimed to have found something that belonged in. So I'll close with this this story. It comes actually from my professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, who is a man named Bruce Metzger, who studied at Princeton University with a man named Paul Coleman Norton. Coleman Norton claimed that when he was in North Africa during the Second World War, he had some. There was a time of relative peace, and he was in a town that had an old mosque, and he was in this mosque. And the leaders of the mosque brought him a book that was in Arabic, but inside the book he found a sheet of paper that had been stuck in the book that was written in an ancient Greek hand, a medieval Greek hand. But as he was a Greek scholar, he was a classicist, and so he was reading this page, and to his amazement, this page was a commentary from the Gospel of Matthew. in which it indicated that one of the stories in the Gospel of Matthew had a longer ending that was previously unknown. In the Gospel of Matthew, there's the story where Jesus is maligning his enemies and saying that they would be cast into the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's the end of the story. But in this commentary that Coleman Norton found, apparently in some manuscripts, the story continued. When Jesus said they'll be cast into the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth, the story continued. The disciples said, "But Master, what of those who have no teeth?" And Jesus replied, "Teeth will be provided." Thank you very much.
Thank you again to Professor Ehrman. Thank you for coming this evening, and give him a few minutes and he'll join you upstairs in the book signing line. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.